Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. Featuring stimulating in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect us all, both locally and globally. And for this, the arts hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And I combine a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. And remember, if you'd like to find out more information about the show or listen to past shows, you can go to the website. It's a question of balance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing award-winning and New York Times best-selling novelist Jonathan Safran Foer. Jonathan's first novel is Everything is Illuminated, which was developed from his prize-winning Princeton thesis and earned him the National Jewish Book Award and the Guardian First Book Award. Liv Schreiber wrote and directed a film version of the book, which starred Elijah Wood. Jonathan's second novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, uses postmodern writing techniques such as visual writing, varied typography, and multiple narrators, and included photographs and a flipbook. Although earning praise and condemnation from the critics, it's sold well and has been made into a film produced by Warner Brothers and Paramount with a star cast including Tom Hanks, Sandra Bullock, Viola Davis, and Max von Sydow. His third novel, Tree of Codes, is an artwork in the form of a book. Jonathan has also written the New York Times best-selling non-fiction book, Eating Animals, which explores our treatment of animals as food. Jonathan was born in Washington, D.C. and attended Georgetown Day School. He went on to study philosophy at Princeton, as well as taking an introductory writing course with the novelist Joyce Carol Oates, who encouraged him in his writing. By stroke of luck, Oates was assigned to be Foer's advisor for his senior thesis exploring the life of his maternal granddad, Holocaust survivor Louis Safran. Jonathan was awarded Princeton's Senior Creative Writing Thesis Prize for his work. After graduating from Princeton, Jonathan enrolled at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, but dropped out to pursue writing. Jonathan's latest novel, Here I Am, was published late in 2016 to great reviews and has just been released in paperback. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Hi.
It's great to have you. Thank you for making the time. I wanted to ask you, obviously your life is embedded in the arts. You're a professional writer. I'm wondering whether you can remember the first piece of art that had a deep effect on you beyond simply entertainment, whether it was writing, painting, music, or something else?
That's a good question. Let me see here. You know, I think different art forms have ways, different ways of reaching us at different points in our lives. Mm. So, for example, I think it's probably pretty rare for a child to be deeply moved by a novel, or to be deeply moved even, I would say, probably by a painting. But music, you know, can find us at pretty much any age. It's just we are wide open for it. Mm-hmm. So I know that when I was a kid, it was probably music and the kind of music that you might expect, like the Beatles, or I happen to remember when Run DMC was on the ascent, and that, for whatever reason, being really important to me. Mm. But the first time that I loved art I guess a little bit more of a sophisticated way, or a way that I was not just, you know, the recipient of something that I thought was cool, but rather more like actively engaged with something that was touching me in a deep way, was probably the sculpture of Joseph Cornell. And that was when I was in college. And I was exposed to his work in a sculpture class, like a making sculpture, not a history of art class. And we would begin each class, the teacher would give us a kind of quick and dirty history of sculpture, and over the course of the semester we were going to move from, you know, the earliest works of art to the most contemporary sculpture. And I remember really vividly that day when these, you know, slides were happening one after another, and he said, "This is Joseph Cornell, he made art in this way, here's what was different about him," and just something about it kind of struck me. And it's not as if I said, "Oh, I love that," but I was just tickled by it. I became curious. And after class, I did something that was completely unprecedented for me at the time, which was I went to the art library on campus and asked if they had any books of his work, which of course they did. And it never stopped growing, that admiration. And he's probably the reason that I wanted to become any kind of artist in the first place.
Interesting. Yeah, I think there's moments where there's a difference between something just making you feel good or be entertained and actually helping one to know oneself a bit better or think about oneself in a different way. Maybe that's a way of distinguishing what happens, as you say, when you're a child, the way you relate to these things and you become more aware.
I think part of it is, as a child or when you're younger, the question is, what can this do for me? You know, and that's true from infancy through adolescence. You know, the question is, in the beginning, it's kind of, how do I survive? And then it becomes, how do I thrive? But that's not a really mature or deep way to engage with art. And I think that maybe what was different about my response to Cornell was I was so interested in the way that it moved me and interested in the possibility of moving somebody else in that way. You know, wondering, was there any chance that I had something to offer in whatever form it might ultimately take that would make somebody feel as his work made me feel?
Right. Yes. Yeah. You've said that you didn't grow up in an especially literary environment, but I'm wondering whether you grew up in a creative environment, would you say, or did you find art for yourself?
It was a very creative environment, but it wasn't creative in a kind of institutionalized way. Like, we didn't go to see lots of plays. We didn't go to see lots of museum or gallery shows. We didn't talk about capital A art, but I did feel that a kind of artfulness like ran through my childhood, whether it was the ways that my dad would, you know, narrate imaginary baseball games as we tossed in the backyard, or the hyper elaborate birthday invitations my mom would make for our birthdays. I definitely grew up believing that with imaginative effort, life becomes better, you know, becomes richer, becomes more shareable.
Yeah, yeah, that's a wonderful gift to have. Yeah. You've expressed that you didn't feel your primary identity was that of a writer and until very recently. So I'm wondering, what was the impetus for you to want to publish your first book and write professionally rather than just maybe do it as a hobby or whatever?
Well, there are many. I mean, the most obvious one is it's a job. And so if you can turn a hobby into a livelihood, you're really, really lucky. So I wanted to see if that would be possible. But it was something more than that as well. And something that changed. You know, when I was younger, I think all of my reasons for wanting to publish have changed. When I was younger, in a way, this kind of rhymes with what I was saying earlier about everything is, the value is in what it can do for you. And I think writing, in a way, was a way for me to get a reflection of myself, to try to find out what I was worth in the world. I don't mean that in any kind of straightforward way, but like, what was good about me? What was interesting about me? What was different about me? I wrote from a position of A, not knowing the answer to those questions, and B, believing that it could be, the answers could be found outside of myself. Mm-hmm. You know, so like it happens, you know, with a lot of young people. Like if I get a good grade, that must mean I'm smart. If I win a prize, that means I'm special. If somebody loves me, that means I'm lovable, and so on.
Yeah.
And I think my first books kind of reflect some of that. You know, they wanted to be charming. They wanted to be liked. And I don't mean that in any kind of judgmental or critical way. I think in a way it's a wonderful position to be writing from. But as I have grown older and I don't question my value in quite the same way, not because I'm so sure of the answer, but because it's just a less important question now that I have kids and responsibilities. And not only does the world not, you know, orbit around me, I'm not even one of the inner planets. So now I write from not from a need to get a reflection, but to explore things that I care about, ideas and feelings, and to try to articulate them in a way that they could be shared.
Right. Yes. Yeah. In Joseph Joubert's notebooks, he observes that writing is closer to thinking than to speaking. And I'm wondering whether you agree with that and what you feel might be conveyed through the written word that can't be through the spoken word.
Well, I don't know that they're different in that way. I think, I don't know that there's all that much that can be conveyed in writing that can't be conveyed in speaking. It's just that with writing, you're not subject to time. You know, when you have a conversation, it always moves from tick to talk, and you can't go back and fix the thing you just said, and you can't return to the party with the joke you suddenly realize you wish you'd made in that, you know, super opportune moment, or that argument that would have refuted the jerk who is you know, sitting across the table from you. You're just stuck in the flow of time. And, you know, it's one of the wonderful things about writing is you're not. And you can know then what you know now and go back and change it and edit it. And so I find it's not so much that I'm presenting a different self, but just a much more careful and refined self.
Yeah. So would you agree with Joubert? Do you think that writing, what comes out as writing, is closer to what's in our head, how we're thinking, than what we speak, for the reasons that you've said?
Well, I think that implies that there's something that's in our head, as if that were a fixed and singular thing.
Right.
You know, there are, first of all, what's in our head is fluid and constantly changing, and it's also totally dependent on the form of expression. So a dance is something that's in our head. A song is something that's in our head. A punch might be something that's in our head. And like rhetoric might be in our head. And they can be, first of all, just different expressions of the same kind of set of thoughts and feelings, but also the ways that they come out influence what it is that's coming out. So, you know, when I write a novel, I am writing my novelistic thoughts. And when I have an argument, I am arguing my kind of rhetorical thoughts. And when I play basketball with my son, it's a totally different kind of expression. And I'm not expressing a novelistic thought. I'm expressing something that was like physical that's inside of me that wanted to get out. But I think one of the things that they have in common is, and this is something that I have felt, this has been a unifying thing in my writing from the beginning, is that there's stuff in us, and a lot of it we're happy to have in us, and some of it we want out of us, not because, maybe because it's painful and it feels unsustainable, or maybe because we want to share it, you know, and that sharing it will make us less alone, or will make us feel in communion and in with others in a way that we long for. So I find that a lot of the things that I do, whether it is sitting down to write a novel or having a phone call with a friend, or maybe even just like taking a walk alone in nature, are responses to this desire, which is really hard to articulate, but the desire to relieve a pressure, to get something outside of me that's on the inside.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I suppose the one thing writing does provide in terms of trying to replicate what we're thinking is that there's a lot of visual thinking, as you pointed out, isn't there, in our minds, and a lot of disparate, fluid thoughts that come in. Whereas when we speak, we tend to try to funnel all of that into something that's going to make sense to whoever we're engaging with. So
yeah.
I guess in a written sense, there's slightly more of a reflection of the diversity of what might be going on in our consciousness at any one moment.
Well, I'm not so sure. Do you feel more? Do you feel more expressive when you have a conversation like this than when you sing in the shower? You know, it's different.
Yeah,
I don't think it's one of them is more complete in the sense that, you know, when you're having a conversation, you have like the full range of the English language and you have the ability to articulate thoughts and to conjure images and all of that.
Mm.
But even in the shower, even without words,
yeah,
it can feel more complete. You know, every painter I've ever known has felt jealous of every writer they've ever known. And every writer I've ever known has felt jealous of every painter they've ever known because of this exact reason that sometimes, you know, you don't want to mean something in a kind of linguistic or intellectual sense. You only want to mean something physically or through the senses.
Yes, yeah.
And a lot of writers are just, I can speak for myself, I feel like incredibly constrained by always having to mean something. And it feels, you know, despite how liberating that might seem, it feels very constraining a lot of the time. And I just wish I could, you know, paint a streak of blue or sing a D sharp.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting.
Not to escape, not to escape, you know, not to escape communication, but to communicate something that feels more, even more essential.
Yes, yeah. Is part of using visual writing techniques a way of bringing that element in, would you say?
I'm not sure. I don't do it anymore.
No.
And I don't know that I would do it anymore. I really don't know. I don't know how to distinguish between, you know, what I was trying to do and who I wanted to be or what I wanted to resist. It's hard to remember.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
I know that at the time it felt more full to me. And in part it's probably because, as you alluded to in the introduction, I didn't always want to be a writer. I sort of came to it through the back door. And because of that, I don't have, or I haven't had the same reverence for the form that a lot of other writers might, you know, people who grew up always wanting to do it and kept diaries and journals and, you know, the kind of person who cannot not write for a day. Well, I can easily not write for a day. And when I do write, I am not writing in the service of any kind of outcome.
Right.
But with a desire to, in a way, create an unexpected or a more authentic outcome. You know, you had said something earlier about thoughts being translated into writing. And that really is not my experience. The poet W.H. Auden said, I look at what I write so that I can see what I think. And that's much closer to my experience. I don't have thoughts that I want to share. I have something that I want to share. I don't know what it is. It's this kind of like a pressure inside of me, something that wants to be on the outside. And it's through writing that I get to see what it is.
Yes. Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest this week, New York Times bestselling and award-winning novelist, Jonathan Safran Foer. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Do you like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Ocean's flat, but steamer lane. No white horses to play the game. And I wish I knew your name. Something about you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, baby, it just goes nowhere. Well, we can do the things we want. We can do the things we like. But if we're taking all the time, well, I just don't think that it's right. I think that there's more to life than just that. I think that there's more to us than just that.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my special guest this week, award-winning and New York Times best-selling novelist, Jonathan Safran Foer. And we heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz in the break there, and if you'd like to see Jonathan in person, he's coming to the Bay Area in July. And if you're in the Santa Cruz area, Bookshop Santa Cruz has a ticketed off-site event with Jonathan on July 12th at 7 p.m. to be held at Santa Cruz High School Theatre. And ticket packages include two tickets to the event and one copy of Here I Am, Jonathan's latest book, which is just coming out in paperback. And you can find out more information and buy tickets in-store at Bookshop Santa Cruz or at their website, bookshopsantacruz.com. It's sure to be a very popular event, so I'd advise getting tickets soon. And for those of you closer to Silicon Valley, Jonathan is also appearing in Palo Alto on July 11th at 7:30 p.m. at the Joshman Family Jewish Community Center. And I'll put information about both events on the podcast page of this interview with Jonathan on the show's website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. So if you go to the show's website, you'll find information about those two events. But he's going to be in the Bay Area in July, so that's going to be great for all of us. So, Jonathan, your latest book, Here I Am, which came out late last year, is just coming out in paperback. It's a story with many layers, but perhaps you could give listeners an idea of what it's about.
Sure. It is about a family in Washington, D.C. in the contemporary moment, a couple, Jacob and Julia, who are in their early 40s, and they have three children. They have parents. They have friends. And we follow them through two crises over the course of about 6 weeks. One is a domestic crisis, which is what seems to be an affair that's discovered on a cell phone. And the other is a global crisis, which is an earthquake in the Middle East, which precipitates a war that becomes so extreme that the Prime Minister of Israel asks all Jews around the world to come to Israel to fight for its survival.
A.O. Scott in The Atlantic states that Here I Am is a big, bombastic celebration of the smallness of life. The intimate minutiae of falling out of love in a marriage is so painful, so carefully documented in Here I Am. The foibles and strengths of families. You get inside the minds and lives of your characters in a very detailed way, yet also there is big life, as you say, an earthquake, war, the place of an entire people. How do you see the big and the small weaving together in Here I Am?
I guess problematically, you know, in the same way that they weave together in life. You know, it's very, very hard to know the scales of things, to how do you weigh the frustrations of some pissy thing your boss said to you against the image that you saw in the newspaper that morning of like a Syrian kid washed up on a beach? How do you weigh the relative sizes of like an infidelity with a passive-aggressive silence or withholding? And, you know, how also do you not let, how do you not either sort of overestimate the size of something in such a way that it becomes impossible to be oneself or to be natural in a relationship, but also how do you not underestimate the size of things in such a way that they accumulate? And that's what happens with Jacob and Julia, a kind of measuring or withholding accumulates between them, and a distance opens up. Despite them being good, thoughtful people, people who love each other, are in love with each other, but this distance opens up that they ultimately find unredeemable.
Yeah. You've spoken of one of the themes of Here I Am being living one's own unique life, and this encompasses being present in our life rather than waking up one day and realizing it's all passed us by. But it also seems to me to be about being our authentic selves, who we truly are, which can be surprisingly difficult. I'm wondering what living your own life means for you and what you wanted to convey about this subject in Here I Am.
I don't know if there's anything I wanted to convey exactly, more like something I wanted to think about. And, you know, for me, it has to do with the title. So the title, Here I Am, refers to one of the most well-known passages in the Bible, which is the story of the binding of Isaac. And it begins, and then God put Abraham to the test. He said, Abraham. Abraham said, Here I am. And God said, I need you to sacrifice your beloved child. And so the sort of common understanding of the test is the sacrifice. But if you read it closely, it could also be understood as just how will Abraham respond when called. You know, and then God put Abraham to the test. He said, Abraham. And Abraham responds in this with this kind of unconditional presence without any reservations. He doesn't need to know what is going to be asked of him. The answer is yes. He's fully there. And then a few sentences later in the story, when he's leading Isaac on Mount Moriah, and Isaac begins to sense that there's something strange going on because they have all of the, you know, ingredients for the sacrifice but not the animal to sacrifice, and he says, my father. Abraham responds with the same word, hineni, which is here I am. And it's a word that's very rarely used in the Bible. And it's a poignant moment because it's paradoxical. Abraham can't be unconditionally present without any reservations for God who wants him to kill his son, while also being unconditionally present for the son who obviously doesn't want to be killed. And that kind of fractured identity spoke to me. And, you know, obviously most people don't live with such dramatic stakes, but everybody knows what it's like to be divided. Not in the sense necessarily, although sometimes, but not necessarily in the sense of a divided allegiance, but just, you know, being one person having a many faceted life.
Yes.
And so, you know, most people find that sustainable. Like, you maybe miss your kid's violin recital so that you can attend an important business meeting, but you don't take a raise at your job so that you'll be able to continue to have dinner with your family. Sometimes people feel that faceted kind of friction between their selves as an individual or their selves in a relationship, or maybe between a kind of parental or familial identity and a romantic or professional identity. But it's sustainable. We borrow from our different identities to give to the others, and we strike balances until something happens that compels an ultimate choice, you know, for you to say, here I am, at the expense of another identity. Mm. As Abraham does. You know, Abraham is prepared to sacrifice his son, so he says the here I am is ultimately to God at the expense of his son. And in the book, this affair and the earthquake create situations in which the characters have to make ultimate identifications.
Right. Here I Am has broad themes applicable to all lives, but it is embedded in the Jewish experience. I'm wondering if this is because you're writing from your own experience or whether you have a specific desire to convey life from a Jewish perspective, and if so, whether you have a certain audience in mind.
I don't have an audience in mind. I think it would be a very bad mistake to have an audience in mind, both from a kind of artistic perspective, but also from a human perspective. You know, one of the first, I think it was the first, actually, radio interview I ever did was for my first book, Everything is Illuminated, and it was in Philadelphia, and someone called in and said, you know, I just want to thank you. You really told my family's story, and for whatever reason, we'd had a hard time talking about it or finding the right language for it, and you gave us a way to. And so as this person was talking, I was imagining basically myself, you know, on the other end of the line. And he continued and said, being a 65-year-old black man in Trenton, I dot, dot, dot. And I kind of giggled, and I looked at the radio interviewer across the table, and she kind of giggled. And then later, as I thought about it, I felt so ashamed of that response, because what inspired it? You know, the idea that only somebody who has the same color of skin that I do could share my story, or could feel that we can relate on the level of story, or only somebody who was born in the same decade, or only somebody who lives in the same city or socioeconomic conditions. And writing should really be the antidote to that, not any kind of reaffirmation of it. So to think about who it is that would be moved by something that I write would require making generalizations that I very much don't want to make.
Even if,
you know, as a human being, they are unfortunately instinctive.
In an interview with Jennifer M. Wood for Wired, screenwriter Aaron Sorkin says, I'm nervous before I do anything. It's just standing at the bottom of the mountain and looking up with no clear path of how you're going to get to the top. I work very slowly, and the first couple of months are spent just pacing around, climbing the walls and saying, I have no idea what I'm going to do. I don't know how to do this. I found this interesting because he's allowing himself to be in his creative process and sort of sitting with his discomfort and allowing himself to create his art in his way without judging himself. And I think that can be quite difficult to do as an artist. And I'm wondering whether this resonates with you at all, and also what your process is from the first impetus to write to actually finishing a book.
Well, it's always changing, you know, and I don't even mean between books. Like every day seems a little different or presents a different kind of challenge. Sometimes I'll go through long stretches of just being unable to do much of anything, and sometimes I'll go through long stretches that feel, well, not that often, but sometimes I'll go through relatively short stretches when everything feels just great and kind of joyous and happy and happens quickly.
Yeah.
It took me 10 years, you could say, to write this book, in the sense that it had been 10 years since I finished my last book. Realistically, I didn't really start this book until about 3 or 4 years ago. And realistically, I wrote maybe 80% of it in the last year. So there are different seasons of writing. And one of them, which I find very hard, is finding out what it is you want to write. you know, what you care about, what you will be able to care about over time without diminishment. And then the other part is the doing. And I find the doing much easier than the conceiving, although it itself is hard in its own ways.
Yes.
But when I turned in this book, after all those years, I remember really vividly the feeling after I emailed it to my editor. I felt so gratified, not because I thought the book was good, or you know, I don't know that I think about books in those terms, and not simply because I was finished, but because I knew that I cared about the book at the end as much as I did at the beginning.
Right.
And that to me is the great struggle as a writer, and it's also the great struggle in everything I do. You know, caring over time. Not have your care, whether it's for another person, whether it's for a profession or a hobby, anything. How do you not have your care diminish over time? How do you find ways to make something new while allowing it to continue to be itself?
Hmm. The novelist Joyce Carol Oates, who you studied with, she said that you had one of the most important writerly qualities of energy. Would you characterize that caring as that energy?
I would.
Yes.
Yeah. I think she meant actually energy in a lot of, I mean, just to correct the record, I don't know that she said I had it. I think she just said it's what you want to have.
Oh, okay.
And I think she was referring to that kind of energy for sure, but also the energy of willpower to wake up, the energy to resist all of the forces that make writers want to stop.
Yeah.
Like self-consciousness, like how logistically difficult it can be, how humiliating it can be, the energy of making each sentence matter, the energy of, you know, being willing to try to reinvent yourself over time. So it's a very broad idea.
Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest this week, New York Times bestselling and award-winning novelist Jonathan Safran Foer. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda Yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, novelist Jonathan Safran Foer. And I just wanted to remind you again that Jonathan is coming to the Bay Area. If you're listening from the Bay Area, he'll be in Santa Cruz on July 12th at 7 p.m. And you can find out more information at the website, bookshopsantacruz.com. You can also go into the store to buy tickets, and I would definitely advise doing that in advance. So that's Jonathan coming to Santa Cruz July 12th at 7 p.m. to be held at Santa Cruz High School. It's an off-site event for Bookshop Santa Cruz. And for those of you closer to Silicon Valley, Jonathan is also appearing in Palo Alto on July 11th at 7:30 at the Joshman Family Jewish Community Center. And as I said earlier, I'll put information on both events on the podcast page of this interview on the show website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, so you can find out more information there. You can, of course, also hear the audio of this interview should you want to hear it again or tell your friends about it. So, Jonathan, I wanted to ask you about your third publication, Tree of Codes, which has been described as an artwork in the form of a book. You took your favourite book, a collection of short stories called The Street of Crocodiles by Bruno Schultz, and cut out words and letters throughout in such a way that a new story was created. Then the work was published as a die-cut book with all the excisions. And I understand you'd wanted to create a die-cut book by erasure for a long time. And I was interested in what drew you to do that, but also the cut-up and fold-in techniques used by Burroughs, for example, are more random than your approach, sort of allowing for the mixing up of words from one context to another and or the revelation of meaning through chance. So I wondered what appealed to you about the process in its entirety, but I also wondered what appealed to you about creating a story from a limited set of words in a linear order, rather than taking the approach of meaning appearing spontaneously?
I have no idea. You know, it was like just a fun. A lot of things. First of all, that may very well be the answer. But, you know, a lot of things in my life are not the result of having thought about them for a long time and carefully laid plans, but just chance. You know, for example, I wrote a libretto for the Deutsche Staatsoper because I got a phone call in the basement one day from somebody who worked there. I said, would you have any interest in this? Something I'd never considered, had no experience with, was totally unprepared to do. I thought, yeah, that could be great. And in the case of Tree of Codes, I got a phone call one day and someone said, look, we're starting this new publishing house and we can't offer you in advance, we can't offer you wide distribution, but what we can offer is to make any book you want, any kind of physical object you want. And I just thought that was a funny kind of challenge almost. And
yeah.
I had been interested in books as objects or artifacts and ways of thinking about, remembering that they have bodies. I've entered the idea, I guess, with this through this process of die cutting, which I'd been interested in. I started thinking about different kinds of books that could be die cut. You know, to what extent it would be visual. Like one of my favorite contemporary artists is named Brian Detmer, who makes these things called book autopsies, where he cuts into picture books or dictionaries, encyclopedias, art books. And they're not meant to be read. They're meant to simply be like a physical object. Or in moving the other direction, as I did here, where it really is more of a book, a proper book that can actually be read from, you know, beginning to end and actually does tell a story.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. I'm very interested in the work of psychologist Alice Miller, who studied different artists and writes about how art can help people process difficult events, whether these are events they've experienced themselves or events they've witnessed. I'm wondering if you feel art can have a healing effect, both on those making art and those experiencing it.
Well, I think, I mean, I do. But, I mean, I think you're asking it in the sense of healing something that's broken, you know, or aiding with trauma, for example.
Well, specifically, but I guess in a wider sense, too.
No, I think in the wider sense, you know, the Polish poet Zbigniew Herbert said that the imagination is the instrument of compassion.
Mm.
I think it's what stories can't help but do, even when they're not trying to, is to, they are sort of documents that care, which distinguishes them from almost every other kind of documents in the world, and documents that reveal what it's like to be a person with. And whether it's the intention or hope, it is always the case that a book makes the world a little bit smaller in the good way.
Yes.
In the sense of recognizing, as I was saying about that caller on the radio show, that, you know, what links us to other people is not the circumstantial and surface stuff, but the deep stuff of story.
Yes.
So, you know, that heals aloneness at the very least.
Yes. I mean, from your own perspective, making art, do you have a sense of any kind of healing or increased integration of your inner life?
I don't know, because I don't have a life to compare my life to, you know? Mm. So I don't know what it would be like if I weren't
a writer. You can't compare it to your, like, earlier life.
I really can't, because that was, there are too many other things that made that different, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if it makes my life easier or harder.
No.
It makes my life both, is the answer. as my own wise shrink would say, and as the shrink in the book, and Here I Am, often says, why so binary?
Yes. So you wouldn't see your art as a kind of therapy?
No. Not for myself, not at all.
Yeah. Okay. You've written a nonfiction book, Eating Animals, which deals with the topics of factory farming and commercial fisheries and our different attitudes towards loved pets and then the treatment of animals that we eat. We live in a time when some children in cities grow up not even realizing that food they eat, such as chicken nuggets, was once a living creature. I'm wondering what you hope readers will take away from this book.
Well, you know, I'm not sure. I think most people do recognize that, you know, meat comes from living creatures. My book is not so much
about... The reason I said that is because I heard this thing on the BBC about, and they interviewed these children from inner cities, and they literally didn't know where the food came from. So I didn't just come up with that from nowhere.
Right.
Yeah, but that, which is fantastical, but it, you know, was true.
I guess anything's... Look, Trump is president, anything's possible. I think the real disconnect is not between animals and food, but between contemporary industrial farming and what people's sort of imagined farm is.
Right, yes.
And my book really isn't about, hey, did you know that, you know, what you're eating was once alive, that it once had feelings, and we should, you know... It's not actually a book from the perspective of animal rights. It's a book from the perspective of, hey, there's this thing going on that probably most of us aren't aware of, and we're not aware of it for very good reason, which is that it is as secretive as any... It's as secretive as like the military.
Yeah.
And if we knew what was going on, not only in terms of the treatment to animals, but what's going on in terms of the scale of the environmental destruction, we wouldn't want it.
No.
We just wouldn't want it. And not because we're, you know, special, not because we have highfalutin ethics, but because we're human beings. And, you know, human beings don't want to see, you know, there's not a listener of this interview who would be perfectly indifferent to, like, a dog being kicked.
No.
Right? There may be some people who would say it's a regrettable but necessary thing in a certain situation, but there's nobody who doesn't feel something there. There's just nobody. And I don't think there's any listeners to this interview who would be indifferent to a pregnant animal being kept in a cage so small she can't turn around for the duration of the pregnancy.
Yeah.
Like, again, some people might say, ugh, if it has to be that way, that's too bad. But there's nobody who's going to say, all things being equal, that sounds great to me. you know?
Yes.
And similarly, you know, there are people who believe in global warming, people who don't believe in global warming. There's nobody who's perfectly indifferent to air pollution or water pollution. It's just, you literally can't even conceive of who that would be. And we know that animal agriculture, factory farming, which is responsible for raising 99% of the animals that we eat, is so far and away the worst thing that humans have ever done to animals, and is so far and away the worst thing we do to the environment. The United Nations said it's one of the top two or three causes of every significant environmental problem on the planet, locally and globally. Loss of biodiversity, air pollution, water pollution, deforestation.
Yeah.
It's kind of, there's a hypocrisy right now, which is really unsettling. And, you know, the outrage over Trump pulling out of the Paris Accords, which whose stated goal was to keep global warming within, I think it was 2 degrees centigrade, when just industrial animal agriculture is more than that. It accounts for more than that difference. But it's a much harder thing to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're virtually at the end of the interview now. There's just a minute or so. And so I just wanted to ask you, you've expressed appreciation for people being interested in your books and have pondered on why people like books. And so I just wanted to end by asking, I'm wondering why you like books. Putting you on the spot for a minute.
No,
answer.
No, it's all right. I think not better than anything else, not better than being in love, not better than having children or friends, but in a way that is unique and extremely powerful. They remind me that I'm alive.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Yes. Well, thank you so much, Jonathan, for coming on the show. And we look forward to having you in this area in July.
I can't wait.
I wish you all the best in the meantime in other places that you're visiting. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
So just to remind listeners again, Jonathan is going to be in the Bay Area in July. Go to itsaquestionofbalance.com to check that out and get the information of where and when he will be in the Bay Area. His latest book is Here I Am, which has just come out in paperback. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. Thank you for joining us, and I look forward to you joining me again next time.